أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأس والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. We continue this evening in our topic that we've chosen for the next upcoming months on knowing the Imam of our time. And for those who were with us last week, we went over just a very brief and basic introduction of the importance of knowing who the Imam is. And just as a recap of the one hadith, we mentioned that the Prophet has been quoted as saying, and this was a unanimous hadith that all Muslims agree upon, that the Muslim who dies and does not know the Imam of their age, the Imam of their time, they die the death of what the Prophet called Jahiliyyah, which was the period of pre-Islam of Arabia, or we can say a death of disbelief, basically. And so we understand the importance as Muslims to know who the Imam of our time is and to recognize the Imam so that we would be able to follow the responsibilities we have to that Imam. Today I want to continue in this discussion and look at, first off, very briefly, the levels of knowing the Imam, but go into a bit about the Imam himself. So obviously when we come to talk about knowing who our Imam is, we have multiple ways that we can study the Imam, as we had talked about previously. In actuality, we have two main ways. We have a basic level where we study the incidental characteristics of the Imam. By incidental, I mean where he was born, when he was born, his parents, the general environment around his birth, things that obviously are not at the whims of us to determine, right? So anything incidental happening about the Imam is one level of the basic level of knowledge of the Imam that we should have. And this obviously doesn't have a lot of importance to it in the sense that, you know, it's not going to make or break us, right? But we need to know just the basics about the Imam, right? There's no, for example, thing that if we don't know the birth date or the place or any of the minor events that happened at the birth of the Imam, it doesn't take us out of the fold of Islam. We wouldn't necessarily not know the Imam, but they are still good things, important things to know about the basics of not only the 12th Imam, the Imam of our time, but obviously all of our important religious personalities, including the Prophet and all of the other members of the Ahlul Bayt. Once we go over the basic facts, then comes the more difficult, which are the advanced issues of knowing the Imam. So for example, specific details about the Imam, he himself, his role, his mission, his status, and signs of the return, right? These become more important because of the fact that our faith is dependent on knowing these things. And I say that our faith is dependent on them because we have seen throughout history that people who did not study these sorts of topics, and not even in history, I mean, I'm not talking 800, 500 years ago, I'm talking even this century, in the last even, let's say, 15 years, movements have come up, even within our community, of people taking individuals to be the Imam, or the son of the Imam, or a direct representative of the Imam. They are actually movements in the world today where they say that the son of the Imam is in a particular country and he has actually attracted tens of thousands of followers. They have active websites. They are propagating their mission in multiple languages. And so we need to be aware of what are the signs that would preclude the Imam from coming. And how do we determine who are false claimants to be the Imam or a close confidant of the Imam? Today I just want to look at one aspect of the Imam in our discussion, in our review, and that is just some facts and figures, those incidental traits of the Imam. And we'll go into one aspect of what is called the ghaiba, or the occultation of our 12th Imam. As we know, his birth occurred on the 15th of Sha'ban in the Islamic year of 255. And that calculates to about July the 19th, 868 of our common calendar. So obviously he has been alive for over 1,200 years at this point, or just short of 1,200 years. He was born in Samarra in Iraq, and obviously contrary to his forefathers who were born in Medina, he was born in Samarra, and there's obviously a historical significance or historical event of how the family got from Medina to Iraq. The father obviously is the 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari, peace be upon him. And the mother of the Imam, unfortunately, a lot is not known about her. We have names, for example, like Narjis Khatun, we have Sausan, Rayhana. These are all names that we can say the mother of the Imam took upon at some point in her life. There is a lot of research being done about who the mother is. And you know, and recently I know there was a movie that came out and we watched it as a community called The Princess of Rome, about the mother of the 12th Imam. This is just one interpretation. It's not the actual, you know, that's not the only event that has been narrated. That's one of the events. That's one of the interpretations that we have in our historical references. But so it's important to know that movie does not represent the only opinion of what our scholars have said. And so there are a lot of things that are being researched and discussed in the academic circles of our scholarship, more about the mother of the 12th Imam, and a lot of specifics about his birth and him coming into this world. Whatever the case may be, when we go on to study his life, we see that the life of the Imam can actually be broken up into three unique compartments. We have from 255, when his birth takes place, to 260, which is the time that the 11th Imam is killed, he's martyred, and he leaves this world. And so that becomes the initial part of the life of the 12th Imam. And he was kept in isolation to an extent. He had been in the company of certain companions in Samarra at that point. And so people saw him. They knew that the 11th Imam had a son who was born. They knew that this was going to be the 12th Imam once the 11th Imam would leave this world. So he was seen and known to some of the companions in that area. But what happens once the Imam dies? Once the 11th Imam dies, we get into a period what our scholars call, and this is based not on their scholarly opinion, but on hadith, and we'll present a few of them tonight. We go into a period called the ghaiba, or the occultation. And the occultation is what I want to look at briefly today, because it becomes a very interesting and a very contentious issue within the Shia community and within Muslims on a whole. Because there are many different definitions that have been put out for what the ghaiba means. What does an occultation mean? You have those who come from the outside who look at the Shia community from other lenses within Islam, and they accuse the Shias of following an Imam who went missing in a basement cellar in Iraq. They say that your Imam was born, he went into this closet, and now you can't find him, he's missing. This is one of the definitions that people give for this ghaiba, this occultation. People also have given strange theories. For example, we're told by people, not by the hadith, but by people, that the 12th Imam is in Bermuda Triangle. And all these boats that go missing and planes that have gone missing in the past hundreds of years, they attribute this to the 12th Imam taking these planes out of the sky. And other people say, no, there's hadith that talk about the 12th Imam being on green land. Right? Is it Greenland, the country? Or is it land which is green? So all of these theories are out there of where the Imam is. And maybe we might have a chance to review or discuss them later, but just to round out this discussion of the facts about the Imam, we believe that he went into a minor occultation and a major occultation. Here, occultation dot being that he was invisible, right? So he's still visible to people. He's still physically on earth. He still is eating, drinking, sleeping. He leads a more or less normal life like everybody else leads. But he has been, we can say, kept from the people. So he doesn't mean he's completely not in touch with humanity. In both the minor and the major, he is still living on earth. He eats, he breathes, he sleeps. He does all of these things, but as we'll see, that it is a way for him to be distanced from society, and we'll give a few reasons why. So the first occultation is what they call the Ghaybatul Sughra, the minor occultation. And this goes for 63 years, from 260 Hijri till 323. And in this period, and we'll look at this more next week, are how did he connect with the community, right? He, and when we look at it, is that he had representatives. He had four specific people who we know their names, we know who they were. They acted as the intermediary. They were the deputies of the 12th Imam for that 63-year period. And they came one after the other. So one would be there, he would pass away. The 12th Imam would then appoint a second one, and so on and so forth, for that entire period of time of the 63 years. Once the fourth representative passes away, we're told in the hadith that this is when the major occultation begins. And this becomes important because this is the period that we are living in today. And obviously it will continue until God deems fit for the 12th Imam to return. And this has obviously been from that time, from 323 till today, which is over 1100 years. And it becomes again important for us to study this time and the traditions about it, because of the fact that I previously mentioned, right, that people will come, people are coming today, claiming to be deputies of the Imam, claiming to be family of the Imam. And they are, you know, taking power, taking money, taking prestige, misguiding the community. Unfortunately, very large numbers of people follow such individuals. And so it becomes again imperative to study the movement. But we see that the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt spoke about this period of occultation in the tradition. So one of the things that some people say is, where does this concept of the ghaiba, of the occultation, come from? Some say that, you know, because you Shias couldn't figure out another way to rationalize an Imam, so you make up this concept of occultation, you make up this word, and now you put your Imam in that box. So here's one hadith that we have from the book Al-Ghaiba of Nu'mani, in which the Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the third Imam, gives us actually details of what would happen at the time of the 12th Imam. And Imam Hussein says alayhi salam, that for the Qa'im, meaning the 12th Imam, there will be two occultations, two ghaibats. The second one, he says, will be longer than the first. In the first one, nobody will know the address where the Imam is, except his select Shia. And in the second one, nobody will know his address, meaning in the longer one, except the true lovers of his religion, and that they will come to know where the Imam is through the Imam himself. So keep in mind, Sayyidul Shuhada, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, was killed in 61 after the Hijrah. The 12th Imam is born in 255. So that's almost 190 years before the 12th Imam comes on the scene. Imam Hussein is telling this to the community, to the companions, to the followers. And we even have hadith from the Prophet even about the 12th Imam and his birth and his role within the revolution of humanity. But here we see a clear indication from the Ahlul Bayt that the occultation is not just a concept we concocted, but there is actually validity to it from the religious perspective. As I mentioned, though, that people say, well, where is the Imam, right? Is he hiding on an island? Is he underwater? Is he on another planet? Is he in another solar system? People have all of these questions. And this is just one hadith that we have from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. And the reference of this book, Muntakhab al-Athar, is a very important book. This is written by a contemporary scholar. He's currently alive today in Qom, Ayatollah al-Udhma Sheikh Lutfullah Safi Gulpaygani. He is one of the Maraja Taqlid. He wrote this encyclopedia about 60 years ago when Ayatollah Borojardi, the great Marja, and his teacher requested him to devote some time to write an encyclopedia of hadith from Shia and Sunni sources about Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. And so over 60 years ago, he came up with a one-volume book, about 500 pages, analyzing all of the hadith from the Shia and Sunni sources, and he put them into a book. Very recently, meaning about 10 or 11 years ago, he actually went back and he redid some more research, and now this book has been published in 3 volumes. So far, I've seen volume 1 and 2 available in English. I think number 3 is still being translated. But this becomes an important work because it's one of the most comprehensive encyclopedias about the 12th Imam. And in this, he quotes a tradition from the 6th Imam about what the Imam is doing or where he's at in a very general term. He says that the companion Sudair, the 6th Imam is speaking to him, and he says that, how can you deny that Allah acts with him, meaning Imam al-Mahdi, in the same way as how Yusuf acted? Right? Go back to Nabi Yusuf in the Quran. You'll see that Yusuf alayhi salam, his father is there, his brothers are there. He's living at Egypt at the time. His brothers come to see him and they don't recognize him. He's in the same room with his blood brothers. Fine, they've been distanced maybe by 10, 15, 20 years, but they didn't know who he was. So the 6th Imam is saying that the 12th Imam's situation is similar. He's in the midst of us, but we don't recognize him as being the Imam. Right? We're told, and just to go off track for a minute, but we're told he goes for Hajj every year. Those who go to Hajj, maybe you've seen him. We won't know until he actually makes his return. We're told he goes to Masjid al-Sahla every Thursday night. Maybe we've been to Masjid al-Sahla in Iraq and we've seen him, but we don't know him as being the Imam. So here the 6th Imam says, he, al-Mahdi, is dealt with in the same way as Yusuf. He walks in the markets. He sits on the rugs. However, the people do not recognize him unless Allah permits him to introduce himself. So there is this clear understanding which breaks all of these stereotypes that non-Shias have about Imam al-Mahdi, that he's hiding in a cave, that he's in the Bermuda Triangle, that he's on Greenland, whatever all of these preposterous theories are. And the 6th Imam shows us, no, he is living amongst you. He eats, he sleeps, he walks, he breathes, he does Hajj. He lives a very normal life other than a few things which are extraordinary that Allah has determined. We also have to understand again that true meaning of occultation, that how is it actually described? This is an interesting quotation that I found that I wanted to share with us. It says that having an imam in occultation means that the people do not recognize the imam. Due to this, it is found in books that when Imam al-Mahdi will reappear, some people will say that we had seen him in our mosques. Some of them then will say that we had seen him in the Hajj, but did not know that he was our imam. Most people would have seen him, but would not have recognized him. So literally, he is living on earth. We don't know who he is. You know, he takes part in gatherings. We may be there in those gatherings. We don't know who he is. So we have to understand that ghaiba, occultation, does not mean he is invisible. He's not like the invisible man that you can't see him. No, he's very much visible, very much alive, very much living, but in a different state. Is he married? We don't know. There are some hadith that talk about him being married, having children. They have government on certain islands on earth. But those are very spurious. They're not really maybe too reliable. So does he have children? We don't know. Is he married? We don't know. You know, what does he do? We don't know a lot of these things. And you know what? At the end of the day, they should not be that important to us. They're good to know, but certain things are kept away from our knowledge. So why have an imam who's in occultation? Why didn't Allah just create the imam at the end of time? As our non-Shia brothers and sisters believe that the Mahdi will be born near the end of time. Or why didn't Allah just give him an extraordinary lifespan and all of us would see him and we would know that this is the Mahdi, he lives in this city, in this country, we could call him up, we could go and visit him. Why didn't Allah just do that, right? Why wouldn't Allah just make it easier for all of us? Give him a 5,000 year lifespan and then tell us about it, right? Then we would all be able to follow him. We would be out of the confusion, the perplexity. But that's where we see that the sixth Imam actually tells us it's a secret. Right? The hadith that we see on the screen shows us that the sixth Imam told us that this is a secret that I don't want you to know, and Allah does not want you to know. So the hadith says that the sixth Imam said that the one who has been entrusted with the command, meaning Imam al-Mahdi, he will necessarily live a concealed life. This will lead those who are already astray into further doubt. So the companion Abdullah ibn Fadl al-Hashimi, he says, I asked the Imam, for why is this occultation going to happen? Right? They were fortunate, they had the Imams around them. They went to this, he goes to the sixth Imam. He says, why? You know, what's the reason? We always want to know why. The Imam says, I'm not permitted to reveal the reason to you. I'm not allowed to tell you why your Imam will go into an occultation. And that is actually one of the, maybe the beauties of Islam. You know, right in the Quran, when you and I read Surah Al-Baqarah, the very first thing we read after Alif Lam Mim is ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدَى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ, that this book is a book of guidance for the people who have taqwa, who are the pious. أَلَّذِينَ يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْغَيْبِ, that we believe in the ghayb, in the unseen. We haven't seen Allah, but yet we believe in Him. We don't see angels, but we believe that we are always with angels. There's a lot of things in the world that we don't see, but we believe in it. Not just Allah, not just the angels, not just the Imam. You know, today we know even science has proven that human beings, you and I, we have a very limited scope of how much we can hear. From 20 hertz in terms of the wave frequency to 20 kilohertz. More than that, lower than 20 hertz, we can't hear those low frequencies. And higher than 20K, we can't hear. But animals, like dogs, they can hear sounds which are beyond our spectrum of hearing. So a lot of things are unseen, but yet we know it exists. Right? We have things called x-rays. Right? You go to the airport, they put your bag in an x-ray machine, they can see through it. So technology shows us that they can see the unseen. Right? So we're always surrounded by unseen in terms of the material world. We just have to take our belief a step higher and say that if in the material world there are unseen, then in the spiritual world there are also unseens that we have to accept and we have to believe in. And there's a beautiful analogy actually in one of the hadith where one of the Imams was asked, you know, how do I rationalize this? Why is it that I'll only know later when the 12th Imam comes? Maybe then we will be told. And there was a beautiful response the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt gave. He says that, he gave the example of the Surah Al-Kahf, chapter 18 of the Quran. There are three stories in Surah Al-Kahf. One is about Nabi Musa and Khidr. Right? And if you've read the story, you know that Al-Khidr, a very wise man who's still alive until today on earth, just like the 12th Imam, he's also alive. He does three things. He kills a child, an apparently innocent child. He puts a hole in a boat, and he builds up a wall to protect some children's fortunes. At every stage of what's happening, Musa asks Khidr, why did you do this? Why did you do this? And Khidr keeps coming back that you don't have the patience to bear what I'm going to tell you. You can't fathom what I'm going to tell you. And so the Imams of Ahlul Bayt tell us that just like Khidr knew something, but Musa wasn't yet ready to understand it, the ghaybah of the 12th Imam is similar, that there is a wisdom behind it because Allah would not do anything without a purpose. But we are not yet at a level of being able to accept why this had to go through. But we do have some probabilities, and I'll come to a close with this last part. That there are some probabilities mentioned in the hadith. Three of them in specific. Why did the occultation have to happen? Number one is that it's a test and an examination for us, the believers, that can we actually accept unseen? Right? We claim it as Muslims. Yes, we read Surah Baqarah. أَلَّذِينَ يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْغَيْبِ. But when it comes down to it, are we really willing to accept that Allah would put a representative on earth, keep him hidden from our sight, and yet we would still believe in him? You know, people say, well, if he was here, it'd make it easier for me to believe in him. I don't agree with that, though. And why don't I agree with it? Because
In 60 AH, Imam Hussein was the Imam of the time. 30,000 people wrote letters to him pledging allegiance to the Imam of the time. They saw Imam Hussein. They spoke to him. They could sit with him and eat food. They could feel him. But yet they turned their back. Right? Even before Imam Hussein, the Prophet, people would see him do miracles, split the moon, split a tree, create miracles, and they would call him a magician. Right? So having an infallible, a divine representative of Allah on earth is not enough. Right? It's not, oh, okay, he's there so I can believe in him, because human beings will always make excuses. So one of the reasons is that we are to be tested by Allah in this particular period. Number two is more about the Imam, that he has freedom from loyalty to any government or country. If he was allowed to have a 2,000-year life, and he lived a normal life like you and I, he was walking, we could meet him, we could email him, where would he live? If he lives in Canada, now he's bound by Canadian law, right? If he wants to travel, he needs a passport. What if the government took it away? You say, well, maybe he lives in Saudi, because his ancestors were from Saudi, because Saudi didn't exist at that time. This is a recent country which has been formed under a family name. But if he was born if his family is from the Hijaz, so he could have that nationality. But now he has to pledge allegiance to the king of Saudi Arabia. So now he's a servant when he should be the ruler. Right? So he can't be living a normal life in terms of living in a particular country and a resident and a citizen of the country, because now he owes his loyalty to that country. And we know in the hadith, when he returns, he is going to annihilate the government of Saudi Arabia. Right? So, you know, he can't be a citizen if he's going to destroy that country. And he's going to destroy a lot. We know that. And we'll probably go into that later on. So he has to be free to do what he wants to do, not being attached to a particular country or citizenship. He has to be free to do as he wishes. And last but not least, we have a hadith from the sixth Imam, which tell us that the 12th Imam is in the occultation for his own safety and protection. Yes, Allah can protect him. Allah can do anything he wants. But as the hadith even tell us, that Allah likes to use natural means to let this world progress. Yes, he will intervene. He's given the Imam an extraordinary life. But Al-Khidr is still alive. Ilyas is still alive. Satan, Iblis, is still alive for millions of years. Right? Angels are still alive. So all of these are still alive. So Allah does sometimes circumvent the law, but in order for the Imam to remain safe and protected and not be attacked and killed, one of the reasons that the sixth Imam gave us was that it would be a means of protection for the Imam himself. We close here because we're coming close to the prayer time. We have a few minutes if there are any questions. If not, hopefully in our next session we will continue to build up on what happened during the minor occultation. This will give us a better understanding of the four representatives of the Imam, what their responsibilities were, how they carried them out. And then hopefully once we're able to continue that discussion and conclude it, we can then begin to look at actually the period of the major occultation and actually delve into more specific issues about the life of our 12th Imam. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Yes. So in terms of, for the ladies' benefit, people ask about ijtihad and mujtahids, when this came about and who the first ones are, when it started. Actually, we can even take it back to the time of the Prophet, right? Although the Prophet was alive in Mecca, Medina, and he would be the sole authority, but we have clear historical narratives and hadith where the Prophet would train companions and give them the tools in order for them to understand problems of the people. And so when the Prophet would send people to, let's say, to Yemen or to other regions, they would also be able to answer questions of the community at that time. So it began with a prophet by him training individuals and scholars, and it continued even for the first 11 imams. So, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam, every imam actually, they had scholars, companions who were trustworthy, they trained, and they were actually at a level of being able to understand the situation and give rulings based on what they had been taught by the imams. So even before the four representatives of the 12th imam, we had scholars, we had companions, I mean, there were companions of the imams who were scholars in their own right, who were basically able to deduce rulings and give those back to the community.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he was taught by Imam Ali.
Okay.
So can he be considered as a mujtahid as well while he was going there as a governor?
If he was giving rulings, we could say that. I don't know if we have clear indication on you know which we have. Obviously, some companions' names are known and why they were sent to certain locations. Some would have been sent purely as political representatives of the imam to rule the govern and society. Other companions would have been sent as religious representatives, but we do have that distinction within the hadith, and we'll see certain companions were sent by the imams, like let's say to Qum, to Nishapur, to Mashhad, to other regions, specifically as scholars for the community, specifically as people to collect the religious dues, the khums and so on and so forth, and to you know either give them to the imam or to spend them. But we'd obviously have to look into the history and see each companion and in what capacity they were sent forth by one of the infallibles.
Right. So, yes. Means that a political representative could be a religious representative at the same time?
It's possible if the imam determined that you know one person was going to be doing you know political representation and a religious role, yes. Yes.
The majority of Muslims who don't believe in him, but not the imam.
Mm-hmm.
Are they to believe a little bit? Because so far they're making fun of Shia. Who is in the heavens and who is your imam? Kind of. But when he appears, when they see from their eyes imam coming and even ruling, so they will become the believers? Or because the situation where that when you see from eyes, start believing. So, in that situation, because Imam is going to fight with the and take the revenge of Karbala, okay, and fight against injustice, definitely very well. So, these people, will they become believers at that time, or?
Well, we'll have to wait and see, I guess. I mean, the hadith tell us that when the 12th Imam's return takes place, the hadith clearly tell us that those who up until the time were believers, were people who prayed, will become disbelievers. And the hadith clearly say that those who up until the time of the Zuhur of the Imam were idol worshippers, who were committing sins, they will convert and come into Islam and follow the Imam. Right? So, I mean, it's impossible to we can't even determine that because, like I mentioned in the beginning, that people saw the Rasulullah and yet they disbelieved in him. Prominent companions who claimed that they believed in the Prophet and they did not believe in him, right? And the Quran calls them munafiqun. Allah devotes a chapter of the Quran. So just seeing the Imam come down, just see him doing all these, you know, all these supernatural events isn't proof, isn't a guarantee that a person will follow him, right? They will come up with other excuses or they will just say this is magic, this is sorcery, this is, you know, Hollywood at its best, you know? So it's hard to tell, and obviously all we know is that we have to protect ourselves, our families and our children, and we have to work at that and let Allah deal with the rest of the people, you know, as He wishes. We end here and we ask Allah to keep us all on the path of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, that He gives us the ability to study and to know the Imam of our time, and we get the ability to be amongst the first round of those who do, are there to help and assist the Imam in his movement to establish a government of justice, of fairness and equality upon this earth. رَبَّنَا تَقَبَّلْ مِنَّا إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ. Let us close by reciting a surah Fatiha and ask Allah to give the thawab of that surah to all of the deceased from our families, our communities, our friends, the ulama and the shuhada who have left this world. Before that one, salawat upon Muhammad.